Chapter 153. A wintry day and night, still impassive, as behoves its breeding, the deadlocked townhouse carries itself as usual towards the street of dismal grandeur. There are powdered heads from time to time in the little windows of the hall, looking out at the untaxed powder falling all day from the sky, and in the same conservatory there is peach blossom turning itself exotically to the great hall fire from the nipping weather out of doors. It is given out that my lady has gone down into Lincolnshire, but is expected to return presently. Rumor, busy over much, however, will not go down into Lincolnshire. It persists in flitting and chattering about town. It knows that that poor unfortunate man, Sir Leicester, has been sadly used. It hears, my dear child, all sorts of shocking things. It makes the world of 5 miles round quite merry. Not to know that there is something wrong at the deadlocks, is to augur yourself unknown. One of the peachy-cheeked charmers with the skeleton throats is already apprised of all the principal circumstances that will come out before the Lords on Sir Leicester's application for a bill of divorce. At Blaze and Sparkles the jewelers, and at Sheen and Glosses the mercers, it is and will be for several hours the topic of the age, the feature of the century. The patronesses of those establishments, albeit so loftily inscrutable, being as nicely weighed and measured there as any other article of the stock in trade, are perfectly understood in this new fashion by the rawest hand behind the counter. Our people, Mr. Jones, said Blaze and Sparkle to the hand in question on engaging him, our people, sir, are sheep mere sheep. Where two or three marked ones go, all the rest follow. Keep those two or three in your eye, Mr. Jones, and you have the flock. So, likewise, Sheen and Gloss to their Jones, in reference to knowing where to have the fashionable people, and how to bring what they, Sheen and Gloss, choose into fashion. On similar unerring principles, Mr. Slattery the librarian, and indeed the great farmer of gorgeous sheep, admits this very day, why yes, sir, there certainly are reports concerning Lady Dedlock, very current indeed among my high connection, sir. You see, my high connection must talk about something, sir, and it's only to get a subject into vogue with one or two ladies I could name to make it go down with the whole. Just what I should have done with those ladies, sir, in the case of any novelty you had left to me to bring in, they have done of themselves in this case through knowing Lady Dedlock, and being perhaps a little innocently jealous of her too, sir. You'll find, sir, that this topic will be very popular among my high connection. If it had been a speculation, sir, it would have brought money. And when I say so, you may trust to my being right, sir, for I have made it my business to study my high connection, and to be able to wind it up like a clock, sir. Thus rumor thrives in the capital, and will not go down into Lincolnshire. By 5:30, post-meridian, Horse Guards time, it has even elicited a new remark from the Honorable Mr. Stables, which bids fair to outshine the old one, on which he has so long rested his colloquial reputation. This sparkling sally is to the effect that although he always knew she was the best groomed woman in the stud, he had no idea she was a bolter. It is immensely received in turf circles. At feasts and festivals also, in firmaments she has often graced, and among constellations she outshone but yesterday, she is still the prevalent subject. What is it? Who is it? When was it? Where was it? How was it? She is discussed by her dear friends with all the genteelest slang in vogue, with the last new word, the last new manner, the last new drawl, and the perfection of polite indifference. A remarkable feature of the theme is that it is found to be so inspiring that several people come out upon it who never came out before positively say things. William Buffy carries one of these smartnesses from the place where he dines down to the house, where the whip for his party hands it about with his snuff box to keep men together who want to be off, with such effect that the speaker who has had it privately insinuated into his own ear under the corner of his wig, cries, "Order at the bar!" 3 times without making an impression. and not the least amazing circumstance connected with her being vaguely the town talk is that people hovering on the confines of Mr. Slattery's eye connection, people who know nothing and ever did know nothing about her, think it essential to their reputation to pretend that she is their topic too, and to retail her at second hand with the last new word and the last new manner, and the last new drawl, and the last new polite indifference, and all the rest of it, all at second hand, but considered equal to new in inferior systems, and to fainter stars. If there be any man of letters, art, or science among these little dealers, how noble in him to support the feeble sisters on such majestic crutches. So goes the wintry day outside the Dedlock mansion. How within it? Sir Leicester, lying in his bed, can speak a little, though with difficulty and indistinctness. He is enjoined to silence and to rest, and they have given him some opiate to lull his pain, for his old enemy is very hard with him. He is never asleep, though sometimes he seems to fall into a dull waking doze. He caused his bedstead to be moved out nearer to the window, when he heard it was such inclement weather, and his head to be so adjusted, that he could see the driving snow and sleet. He watches it as it falls, throughout the whole wintry day. Upon the least noise in the house, which is kept hushed, his hand is at the pencil. The old housekeeper, sitting by him, knows what he would write and whispers, "No, he has not come back yet, Sir Leicester. It was late last night when he went. He has been but a little time gone yet." He withdraws his hand and falls to looking at the sleet and snow again until they seem, by being long looked at, to fall so thick and fast that he is obliged to close his eyes for a minute on the giddy whirl of white flakes and icy blots. He began to look at them as soon as it was light. The day is not yet far spent when he conceives it to be necessary that a room should be prepared for her. It is very cold and wet. Let there be good fires. Let them know that she is expected. Please see to it yourself. He writes to this purpose on his slate, and Mrs. Rouncewell with a heavy heart obeys. "For I dread, George," the old lady says to her son, who waits below to keep her company when she has a little leisure, "I dread, my dear, that my lady will never more set foot within these walls." "That's a bad presentiment, mother." "Nor yet within the walls of Chesney Wold, my dear." "That's worse." "But why, mother?" "When I saw my lady yesterday, George, she looked to me, and I may say at me too, as if the step on the ghost's walk had almost walked her down." "Come, come. You alarm yourself with old story fears, mother." "No, I don't, my dear. No, I don't. It's going on for 60 years that I have been in this family, and I never had any fears for it before. But it's breaking up, my dear. The great old Dedlock family is breaking up." "I hope not, mother. I am thankful I have lived long enough to be with Sir Leicester in this illness and trouble, for I know I am not too old, nor too useless to be a welcomer sight to him than anybody else in my place would be. But the step on the ghost's walk will walk my lady down, George. It has been many a day behind her, and now it will pass her and go on." "Well, mother dear, I say again, I hope not." "Ah, so do I, George," the old lady returns, shaking her head and parting her folded hands. "But if my fears come true, and he has to know it, who will tell him?" "Are these her rooms?" "These are my lady's rooms, just as she left them." "Why, now," says the trooper, glancing round him, and speaking in a lower voice, "I begin to understand how you come to think as you do think, mother. Rooms get an awful look about them, when they are fitted up, like these, for one person you are used to seeing them, and that person is away under any shadow, let alone being God knows where. He is not far out. As all partings foreshadow the great final one, so, empty rooms, bereft of a familiar presence, mournfully whisper what your room, and what mine must one day be. My lady's state has a hollow look, thus gloomy and abandoned. And in the inner apartment, where Mr. Bucket last night made a secret perquisition, the traces of her dresses and her ornaments, even the mirrors accustomed to reflect them, when they were a portion of herself, have a desolate and vacant air. Dark and cold as the wintry day is, it is darker and colder in these deserted chambers than in many a hut that will barely exclude the weather. And though the servants heap fires in the grates, and set the couches and the chairs within the warm glass screens that let their ruddy light shoot through to the furthest corners, there is a heavy cloud upon the rooms which no light will dispel. The old housekeeper and her son remain until the preparations are complete, and then she returns upstairs. Volumnia has taken Mrs. Rouncewell's place in the meantime, though pearl necklaces and rouge pots, however calculated to embellish bath, are but indifferent comforts to the invalid under present circumstances. Volumnia, not being supposed to know, and indeed not knowing, what is the matter, has found it a ticklish task to offer appropriate observations, and consequently has supplied their place with distracting smoothings of the bed linen, elaborate locomotion on tiptoe, vigilant peeping at her kinsman's eyes, and one exasperating whisper to herself of, "He is asleep." In disproof of which superfluous remark Sir Leicester has indignantly written on the slate, "I am not." Yielding, therefore, the chair at the bedside to the quaint old housekeeper, Volumnia sits at a table a little removed, sympathetically sighing. Sir Leicester watches the sleet and snow, and listens for the returning steps that he expects. In the ears of his old servant, looking as if she had stepped out of an old picture frame to attend a summoned deadlock to another world, the silence is fraught with echoes of her own words, "Who will tell him? He has been under his valet's hands this morning to be made presentable, and is as well got up as the circumstances will allow. He is propped with pillows, his gray hair is brushed in its usual manner, his linen is arranged to a nicety, and he is wrapped in a responsible dressing gown. His eyeglass and his watch are ready to his hand. It is necessary less to his own dignity now perhaps than for her sake, that he should be seen as little disturbed, and as much himself as may be. Women will talk, and Volumnia, though a deadlock, is no exceptional case. He keeps her here, there is little doubt, to prevent her talking somewhere else. He is very ill, but he makes his present stand against distress of mind and body most courageously." The fair Volumnia, being one of those sprightly girls who cannot long continue silent without imminent peril of seizure by the dragon boredom, soon indicates the approach of that monster with a series of undisguisable yawns. Finding it impossible to suppress those yawns by any other process than conversation, she compliments Mrs. Rouncewell on her son, declaring that he positively is one of the finest figures she ever saw, and as soldierly a looking person, she should think, as what's his name, her favorite life guardsman, the man she dotes on, the dearest of creatures who was killed at Waterloo. Sir Leicester hears this tribute with so much surprise and stares about him in such a confused way that Mrs. Rouncewell feels it necessary to explain. "Miss Dedlock, don't speak of my eldest son, Sir Leicester, but my youngest. I have found him. He has come home." Sir Leicester breaks silence with a harsh cry. "George? Your son George come home, Mrs. Rouncewell?" The old housekeeper wipes her eyes. "Thank God. Yes, Sir Leicester. Does this discovery of someone lost, this return of someone so long gone, come upon him as a strong confirmation of his hopes? Does he think, shall I not, with the aid I have, recall her safely after this, there being fewer hours in her case than there are years in his? It is of no use entreating him. He is determined to speak now, and he does. In a thick crowd of sounds, but still intelligibly enough to be understood. Why did you not tell me, Mrs. Rouncewell? It happened only yesterday, Sir Leicester, and I doubted your being well enough to be talked to of such things. Besides, the giddy Volumnia now remembers with her little scream that nobody was to have known of his being Mrs. Rouncewell's son, and that she was not to have told. But Mrs. Rouncewell protests, with warmth enough to swell the stomacher, that of course she would have told Sir Leicester as soon as he got better. "Where is your son George, Mrs. Rouncewell?" asks Sir Leicester, Mrs. Rouncewell, not a little alarmed by his disregard of the doctor's injunctions, replies, in London. Where in London? Mrs. Rouncewell is constrained to admit that he is in the house. Bring him here to my room. Bring him directly. The old lady can do nothing but go in search of him. Sir Leicester, with such power of movement as he has, arranges himself a little to receive him. When he has done so, he looks out again at the falling sleet and snow, and listens again for the returning steps. A quantity of straw has been tumbled down in the street, to deaden the noises there, and she might be driven to the door perhaps without his hearing wheels. He is lying thus, apparently forgetful of his newer and minor surprise, when the housekeeper returns, accompanied by her trooper son. Mr. George approaches softly to the bedside, makes his bow, squares his chest, and stands, with his face flushed, very heartily ashamed of himself. Good heaven, and it is really George Rouncewell! Exclaims Sir Leicester. Do you remember me, George? The trooper needs to look at him, and to separate this sound from that sound, before he knows what he has said. But doing this, and being a little helped by his mother, he replies, I must have a very bad memory, indeed, Sir Leicester, if I fail to remember you. When I look at you, George Rouncewell, Sir Leicester observes with difficulty, I see something of a boy at Chesney Wold I remember well, very well. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.